Good afternoon. We're going to dive in right now. Hello, we're waiting. I'm Peter LaPage. I'm the Dean of College of Arts and Sciences. And Mike Kotlikoff and I are here to talk to you a little bit about faculty renewal and then answer a lot of questions. And my job here is to give you a little bit of an overview of what we're talking about, what the situation is. And the biggest challenge that pretty much every college at Cornell is facing right now is the age distribution of their faculty. I've shown here what the age distribution looked like in 1983, shortly after I came. This is number of faculty at age 30, at age 40, at age 50, age 60, age 70. And you can see it's piled up down around the 30s and 40s. Back in 1983, and indeed for most of Cornell's history up until then, half the faculty were under the age of 45. And relatively few were over retirement age, over 55. Back then it was 23%, I think, in 1983. These are Arts College numbers. The university numbers look similar. What happened between 83 and 93 is this mound of people who were young in 1983. By 1998, they were middle-aged, and by 2010, that lump is, well, they're a little stooped like all of us when we get older, but it's this mound here, basically, is that mound of people that just move through our age distribution and move through the ages, and we are now facing the heaviest retirement rates we've ever had in the history of Cornell in 150 years. We have the oldest faculty in the history of the college. As I say, 47% are over the age of 55. That's roughly the same number for Cornell as a whole. In the Arts College, 20% of our faculty, 100 out of 500, are over the age of 65. Our typical retirement age in Arts and Sciences is around 68, 68 and a third or 68 and a half. And so most of these people are going to retire in very short order, and indeed a lot of these people are going to retire in very short order. We are facing the heaviest retirements in history, and what really is happening during the next 5 or 10 years is we're taking all the famous people who taught you, we're sending them off to wonderful retirements all over the place, and replacing them with people who have to be just as spectacular and as the people who are retiring. And we're basically hiring our reputation for the next 20 or 30 years during this next decade. So to show you the numbers for Arts and Sciences, just a sort of tentative hiring plan. By the way, these graphs here are part of, we built a computer model for our faculty, a fairly detailed model. And it allows me to sort of look into the future reasonably reliably if you're studying things like retirements, because anyone who's going to retire 5 years from now is on our faculty now. I know how old they are. I know what the probability is of a 69-year-old retiring. So I can make fairly accurate projections. And we've been projecting out into the future. And what is happening, basically, is we're going from a distribution like this, which was an artifact of the 100 years of Cornell's growth, where it doubled in size every 15 or 20 years. That growth stopped in the 1970s, and when you're not growing anymore, you don't have an age distribution like this. After a while, your age distribution looks more like this, kind of flat, much, much flatter. And we're undergoing, in this decade, the end of the transition from that old distribution to this new one. So what does that mean for the college? It means that I have to hire 27 faculty per year just to replace the people who are retired or rated by other universities, or if they're young people, they may not have made tenure. We have very high standards for promotion. And I have to hire 27 people a year just to maintain my current size. This is a huge number of people. You know, over 10 years, you're talking about almost 300 faculty members, rather, 270 faculty members. That's out of a faculty of 500. So that's more than half the faculty will turn over in the next decade. And actually, a third of them turned over in the last 7 years since I've been dean. We replaced 150 in the last 7 years. So we're going up. We're notching it up several notches for the next decade. But we're basically replacing a substantial part of the college, very large part, the majority of the college during this decade. This is a huge amount of hiring to do every year, and I have a concern about having enough faculty in the pool to hire, especially since a lot of other universities have the same demographics. And that causes me to be very eager to get into the hiring market as quickly as possible, and if anything, to front load the hiring. So we're doing more hiring now than we need. And that's what this sheet is about. This is a program that we have designed here at the university to help us take advantage of an extraordinarily good hiring market right now. A lot of our competition is competing universities are still on the ropes financially from the financial crisis. We in the Arts College have been extremely aggressive about budget cutting. We've absorbed very large cuts over the last 2 years, 10% cuts in our budget. But as I told the faculty, we wanted to do this very quickly as possible, partly for morale reasons, but also partly because we need to deal with problems like this turnover in our faculty, and we have to get to it as quickly as possible. After some pretty aggressive budget cutting, we find ourselves in a position now where we can, in fact, deal with this problem. And part of dealing with it is to try and hire people, not just people for open positions, but hire people against positions that will open up in 4 or 5 years. So we need bridging funds to get us through those 4 or 5 years. We want to do that because of this extraordinary hiring market, this really tremendous hiring market right now. And so it will actually cost a fair amount of money to do the extra hiring, because these hires, in the long run, we have funding for them as soon as the position that we're hiring them for is freed up by a retirement 5 years from now. But in the short run, we need funds to acquire the people for these positions and to pay their salary for 4, 5, 6 years, whatever it takes to get to the retirement. Through our modeling, we estimate that if we do this 5 to 7 extra hires per year for 5 years, it'll cost us about $15 million of college money, $14 to $15 million of money that we fundraise through the program that is described on the sheets on your seat. We're trying to get cash. This is cash, not endowment. It's cash to allow us to make these strategic prefills. And this is an aggressive move on our part. It's not the financial risk is limited in the sense that we're adding 5 to 7 hires, but it's on a background of 27 hires for which we have the funding because people are retiring, and so we have the salaries. So if we have a problem with the fundraising or something disastrous happens to the, more disastrous happens to the economy, we can actually pull way back on the hiring here and recover quite quickly after about a year. So it's not extremely risky. This is about as many as I think we could manage to hire, just given how much work it is to hire people. But I think this will have a big impact, especially on strategic issues. We won't spread these extra hires, this bridge money, uniformly across the college. I asked every department in my college at our first chairs meeting in August. First of all, I stunned them by telling them that we were going to increase our hiring by a factor of 6 this year over last year. We hired almost no one last year. because we didn't have the money. We were too busy budget cutting. I stunned them by doing that. Then I irritated them by telling them I needed a 5 to 10 year hiring plan from each of them, and I needed it in 3 weeks. They didn't like that, but I explained to them that this is really a project of the next 5 years at least, if not 10 years. And it's something where so much of your department is turning over. You really want to think hard about where you want to be at the end of that period, what you want to change. This is a gigantic opportunity to update your department, to deal with issues, to modernize it, to deal with any issues that you've had. And I really want my departments to be as strategic about this as possible. These funds will go to all sorts of departments, but it'll go to the departments that actually have the best strategies, you know, in our judgment. We're working very closely with them. I have a book now, Strategic Plans, from them. Some of them are great, and some of them we're going to have a lot of work with the departments in teaching them what we mean, what the word strategic plan means. So it's really all across the college that we have this. There are a few departments that have gone through the age transformation, but the majority have not. And it's a big challenge. It's scary to have your most famous people leaving, but it's also a gigantic opportunity and one of the most exciting. Really, we're in for one of the most exciting 3, 4, 5 years that we've had in decades. It'll be certainly since the 60s. Which was the end of that sort of exponential growth period at Cornell. This is kind of the high-level view of what we're doing in arts and sciences. I think Mike's going to give you a little more detailed view of what's going on in the Vet College, and then both of us are going to answer questions afterwards. So I'll turn it over to Mike Kotlikoff. Thank you.
Thanks. Good afternoon, everybody. I thought I'd start with just a little bit of an overview of the Veterinary College for many of you that aren't as familiar with the Veterinary College as with arts and sciences. So I'll talk a little bit about the general aspects of the college, where we are. We've just gone through a strategic planning process that we ended a year ago. I've been dean now just over 3 years. After the first year, I think I don't think there are two more terrifying words that a dean can utter to their faculty than the words strategic plan. but I uttered them, and we hadn't done one, and we've gone through, and I'll give you a little sense of that. Talk about the challenges Peter has that where we are in the demographics of the Veterinary College, a smaller college, professional school on campus, and then how do we replace some of the iconic Cornell faculty that are really responsible for our current reputation. So the Veterinary College is the top-ranked veterinary college. It's been top-ranked for more than 10 years, actually, and it's, as I say, not due to anything that I've done, but due to the history and legacy of Cornell faculty before me. We're the first veterinary college to grant a veterinary degree, first college to grant a veterinary degree in 1886. That was to an individual, Dr. Salmon, for whom Salmonella was named, and that may be a bacterium that you're familiar with. It's gotten a lot of press lately. We are a school that, of course, trains DVM students and PhD students. We are also a biomedical research school on the campus. We have the largest NIH portfolio of any school on campus and the largest NIH portfolio of any veterinary college in the country. And that's something I'm extraordinarily proud of and something that actually brought me to Cornell, my colleagues here. We're, however, one of the smaller schools in the top tier in terms of number of students, and that's a challenge for our finances. I'll talk just a bit about that. Veterinary schools have a very high cost of education per student relative to the starting salary. And that's a trend that's really emerging in veterinary medicine, which is the indebtedness of our students has exploded. It's starting to impact who is coming into the profession, who decides to become a veterinarian, and it's certainly affecting what those individuals do when they graduate from our school, what areas of veterinary medicine they go into, and how they can afford to pay back their debts. As I said, we've just gone through our strategic planning. So our overarching goals from that strategic plan, Cornell, as I said, has been number one ranked in the country. We really want to be globally recognized as the leader in animal health education broadly. And we have a number of plans that we're pursuing globally in China, in the Middle East, and in other areas. And that's part of what's going to happen in the next 10 to 20 years as our concept of animal health in agriculture and in companion animals really becomes the standard for the world. You can start to see this happening already in Asia, an aging population with very, very restricted children, and that aging population really looking for companionship and pets exploding in China. We need to strengthen our premier DVM program, for which we're ranked number one, and we have lots of plans at trying to strengthen that program, and then enhance our position as the top-ranked veterinary college in biomedical discovery, as I mentioned, enhance our already significant portfolio. So, how do we do that? Our specific strategic goals are we're planning to modestly increase our class size to address some of the workforce issues and really insulate the college from the coming state budget cuts that we know are coming as the state deals with a $9 billion deficit, even after what has been a 12% cut in our state funds over the last 2 years. We need to improve our DVM preparation and education. There's a lot of programs in which we're partnering with individuals to try and get our students more clinically capable when they graduate. That's something that's a trend in medical education in general, this trend towards outcomes assessment and clinical competence. We want to improve the recognition and financial health of our clinical programs. We'll open a new clinical center in Stamford, Connecticut, this January, and that's something that's a great departure for Cornell, a first time, but very important for us addressing the New York metropolitan market for philanthropy, to be able to infuse academic medicine in a very, very important market. And then we're strengthening our basic and clinical research. I'll talk a little bit about our recruiting and improving our diversity and climate while we do that. That's very important for us. So this is my analog of Peter's slide. We're actually a little bit worse off than the Arts College. If you look, Peter's was 47% over 55. We're now 57% over 55. And if you look at this trend by year, you see that we're just moving forward. This is, again, showing the elephant and the snake. If you look in the bulge in the snake. If you look at this in 1990, as recently as 1990, the core of our faculty was between 30 and 50. Then this moves up and moves up again. And we now have more than a third of our faculty that are greater than 60, and we're looking at a major demographic change, very, very like what Peter showed. We have a smaller faculty, however, and we're estimating 5 to 6 retirements per year over the next 5 years. We have approved and planned hires of about 20. We're looking to pre-fill 9 to stay at steady state within our budget. We need to be able to do this and fundraise to be able to use current use funds, as Peter says, to be able to anticipate this exodus of the faculty that are responsible for the reputation that I described. It's very important to do that in a proactive and thoughtful way, as Peter described, because, of course, you don't want these departments with these great reputations to collapse, the faculty to leave, and then to have to rebuild them again. You want to hire faculty that are attracted to work with these people with this reputation and allow them then to grow and replace that in a coordinated way. And that's really, really critical, or we'll lose our ranking. So the plan is to assume no net increase in our faculty. We're actually modeling a slight decrease of 2 or 3 faculty positions. We will hire to our strategic plan and that will be to strengthen our DVM program, so to strengthen the clinical competency of our students. We need to hire the clinical experts that will replace some of the experts that will retire. In research, our priorities are in cancer, genetic medicine, where we've just received a phenomenal $10 million gift, the biggest gift the veterinary college has ever received from an anonymous donor. I meet with our faculty all the time, or our alumni all the time, and I hear our alumni whispering to each other, "I'm the $10 million donor." I happen to know who the $10 million is. In infectious disease, where we have a tremendous reputation, and in reproductive biology and developmental medicine, also one of our great strengths. We will improve the recognition and financial health of our hospital. We've turned over our hospital directorship and leadership in that area, and we've really made remarkable gains. It's one of the reasons we've been able to weather this financial storm is by really turning around the financial performance of our hospital. And then, very importantly, we will leverage this and this. That is, leverage our superb biomedical science, basic science portfolio and scientists to try and build clinical research. The same pressures that are occurring, the same trends in human medicine, and that's a great opportunity for us as we look to grow our NIH portfolio. We have a little bit of a different culture in the veterinary college. We hire chairs, give them financial authority, so they have their budgets, and they have the responsibility and the expectation to build their departments and succeed. We hire chairs for a 5-year term. If they do well, they get a second 5-year term. At the end of 10 years, we go out and get the best chair we can find nationally or internationally. We've done that recently. It's been very successful. We've turned over 6 of our 8 chairs or directors. I'll show you some of those. And they have, as I say, authority and accountability. And we use this opportunity to recruit the national experts, the best people we can bring to Cornell, and to, at the same time, improve our diversity as we do this. And so here's a caption of our diversity efforts so far. This was 2007, yours truly included here. These were our 5 chairs and Baker Institute director, and you can see there's a bit of a common theme. This is 2010 now. Judy Appleton is the associate, she's the acting director of the Baker Institute and our associate dean for academic affairs. Done a great job over the last 2 years at the Baker Institute. Maureen Linder was recruited from WashU. She worked with Al Gilman, a Nobel laureate, a terrific biochemist, chairs our Department of Molecular Medicine, and is now recruiting into that department. Avery August, again, a tremendous recruit from Penn State, an infectious disease immunologist, somebody that was really, really recruited at many, many places, an emerging star. And Avery chairs, like I do, is a chair of one of the NIH divisions, Board of Scientific Counselors. And Avery is recruiting into microbiology and immunology, a great strength at Cornell. Then Margie McEntee was recruited she's the acting chair of the Department of Clinical Sciences, our very important department in clinical sciences. Margie's father was a Cornell faculty member, so she was easy to attract. So we will have replaced 6 of 8 of our chairs over a 3-year period and turned those over. And they're recruiting and rebuilding their departments, and it's very important that we give them the ability to do that. We've done that in a measured way, 1 a year for the next 3 years, and that's something that allows them to start to anticipate this retirement. We would like to do more, frankly, but we're constrained by our turn down financially, this 12% cut from state funds. We had a 20% turn down in our endowment payout, and that's really restrained our ability to respond more quickly. I just want to show, our diversity. We've had great successes. This has been a coordinated effort, both the chairs that I showed you, but those chairs also. We've put a lot of effort into this in trying to increase the pool of what was really a very non-diverse faculty as veterinary medicine changes from a profession that was largely grew out of agriculture and was white male and is now, of course, our students are 70 to 75% women. We've done a great job at diversifying the faculty now. Our percentage of women has increased at every academic rank between 2006 and 2010. 64% of our STEM assistant professors now are women. 32% of all of our faculty are women. This is the same pool that we recruit from STEM Cornell-wide. This is not veterinarians. These are basic biology faculty. We've made good progress on underrepresented minorities in the student body. We've made less progress in the faculty, and that's something we're working very hard on. And then just I'll end with some of the iconic Cornell faculty that we really need to replace. Skip Carmichael discovered parvovirus in the dog. He's the person responsible for the vaccine that everybody, one of you who's a dog owner, gives to their dog, a longtime faculty member at the Baker Institute. Francis Fox, he's the guy that you see on the bridge as you drive into Ithaca. Francis retired recently, an ambulatory veterinarian of the old school and just a tremendous, tremendous Cornell faculty member. Sandy Della Hunta, an individual who invented neurobiology and clinical neurology in veterinary medicine. Many of you may know Howie Evans, the anatomist who leads tours and has written the books in veterinary anatomy. Bob Kirk, who wrote the internal medicine text in veterinary anatomy, and then in veterinary clinical medicine, and then Bob Wasserman, a National Academy member that led our basic science section for many years. So I'll leave you with those individuals. That's really the challenge. Those are the people we're trying to rebuild for the future. And I guess Peter and I will take questions.
I think we go to the microphone because this is being recorded. So if you dare.
As a recent parent of an arts school student, we've been really concerned about the undergraduate experience.
That microphone's not on.
No, we're turning it up.
There should be a switch.
Switch.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay, I was saying, for your recent parents at the art school, and we're really concerned about the undergraduate experience at Cornell, so I'm wondering if your strategic plans for hiring faculty focus on hiring teachers as opposed to stars who come in and are not necessarily great teachers or may or may not speak great English.
Okay. Are you a current parent or
no, graduated.
What class?
09.
So recent, yeah. Actually, I'm a current Cornell parent, and I had an 05, an 08, and one is graduating in a couple of months. And I can't tell you the kind of interesting information you get when you have kids in your own college. And it all ends this year. I should probably quit being dean. Of course, a really important consideration. It's a vital consideration, and the fact of the matter is that everyone, all the faculty at Cornell teach, and almost everyone teaches undergraduates. When I was physics chair, I recruited people always in the conversation at some point. You told them, you know, at Cornell, we all teach, it doesn't matter, I mean, in the physics department, it doesn't matter how many Nobel Prizes you win, you still have to teach. And indeed, the last guy who won the Nobel Prize in physics, David Lee, or one of the guys who won it that year, back in the 90s, when they call you from the Nobel Committee, they call you at 4:30 in the morning, you know, it's middle of the day in Sweden. They call you, you're stunned, you hang up, and then your phone rings off the hook because the New York Times is calling you, the ABC is calling you, everyone and his uncle is calling you, the president of the university is calling you, everyone. And he had to take the phone off the hook around 7:30 because he had an 8 a.m. recitation section that he was teaching as part of the staff of a big intro physics course. He was not the main lecturer, he was teaching one of the recitation sections and an 8 a.m. section at that. And he came in, he was 5 minutes late, and he apologized to the class and said, you live to have a line like this. He said, I'm sorry I'm late, I won the Nobel Prize this morning. And then spent 50 minutes telling them why he had won the Nobel Prize and what for and what about. I'm sure they don't really remember the details, but every one of those kids remembers the day their faculty member won the Nobel Prize and talked to them about what it's like to win a Nobel Prize. He was one of our senior faculty at that point. He retired just a couple of years ago. Already extremely eminent, as you can imagine, and in fact, his Nobel Prize was 20 years overdue. But everyone teaches, and it just goes without saying, it's really the whole rationale for the Arts College is, in fact, the liberal arts teaching program. That's what it's about first and foremost.
And maybe I could just add a little bit to that. Undergraduate education is distributed all through Cornell. We in the veterinary college teach a significant amount of biology, undergraduate biology. It is something that we're in this reimagining Cornell that we're talking a lot about. How to make that undergraduate experience, whether you're a Cal student, an art student, human ecology, how to make that a unique experience. And we've had a lot of conversations about how to get out of the way of that, how to make budget issues not the determining factor in that experience. And I really think, having served on the University Budget Committee, I really think we're making progress in that regard as well.
Microphone's open.
Peter, could you please talk about the age distribution? You'd mentioned 27 new hires each year over the next 5 years, but I'm assuming that's a mixture of professors that are younger. A professor in his mid-40s would be with the school for another 20 years, but if you could just address that, please.
Yeah. One of the problems with our age distribution is that we've got a gap. We've got a lot of people over the age of 55, and we have a lot of people under the age of 45, but if you were looking at the little pictures I was showing, there's actually a big dip between 45 and 55, which is a problem. It's again a kind of a natural thing. It's one of these things that was almost unavoidable, even though you could have predicted it 40 years ago. It makes it very hard to find new leadership, new chairs for departments, new deans, and so on with that gap. And so we're trying hard to hire a larger fraction of the new faculty. I'd like them to be a little bit more senior in order to provide leadership. Historically, about 70% of the faculty we hire are assistant professors, so beginning their careers. 30% are older. And if I had my druthers, it would be more like 60-40 over the next decade. But it's hard to do, although the economic crisis does create opportunities because there are people who are getting very worried, mid-career people are getting very worried about their home institution now. One of the really sad things that's happening to American higher education now, and we feel it at Cornell in part, as well, but is the extent to which, in particular, state universities are being very badly damaged by state legislatures and state economies, which is sad, but it actually does mean there are faculty freed up who one might want to rescue.
Hi, my name is Ronna Glasgow, class of 87, engineering. And I think that when you embark on an ambitious program of hiring, or any hiring for that matter on the faculty side, there are recruitment challenges. Where I work at Stanford University, our challenge is the ridiculously high cost of living. People have sticker shock and run in the other direction.
Yeah, we discuss it. We discuss it with the guys that we're competing with you for. So have you looked at a house in Palo Alto? I'm a PhD from Stanford, by the way. So I have a PhD from Stanford. So part of me likes Stanford, but only part. Yeah.
And so I'm wondering what your challenges are when you're trying to recruit here, and how you handle those challenges. And obviously, I work for Stanford, and if you tell any recruiting secrets, I promise not to blab about them when I get back to the office on Monday. But it's a unique recruiting situation at every college and university, and I'm wondering how you guys handle that here.
Yeah, I'll just start the. I don't know that there's any secrets. The Ithaca has certain advantages for recruitment, and Cornell, obviously, this is a terrific and unbelievably collaborative institution. I was on the faculty at the University of Pennsylvania for many years, and Penn calls itself one university, but it's not like Cornell where you. It's virtually in the water that you collaborate, and you can't not collaborate because you go to a restaurant and you meet your colleagues. You go to the airport and you can't not meet your colleagues. So there is a kind of ethos in the place that helps. We, on the other hand, we're a very small community, and dual career families is really a challenge for us. Dual academic families are a real, real challenge for us. We have we're constantly talking and collaborating about how we can make this work. In fact, Maureen Linder's husband, who came with her from St. Louis while she was a physicist, who's working and teaching in Peter's old department. And so we really try to help each other and work these things out. The other thing I'd say is that there are certain people for whom Ithaca is the destination of choice. It is a place where the public school systems work like almost no other. Two of my kids are Ithaca school system graduates, or one about to and one already, and just an enormously successful, inspiring educational system in the community. So there are a lot of good things that we can tell. And then the last thing I would say is Peter and I don't recruit so much. Our faculty are the reason that people come here. And that's a key thing. They come for the environment and to work with faculty. And that's why it's so critical to maintain this strength and why it's so hard to build back.
So following that up, in corporate America, when we're growing our companies, a lot of times we pay referral bonuses to employees that are there. When they give us a resume of a colleague of theirs that they may have gone to school with or worked with previously, and they can vary from $5,000 to $10,000 depending on the level of the employee. And I know it might be out of the box thinking in higher ed, but I'll tell you, it does work. And when you have a 26-year-old accountant that went to school with another accountant and they recommend them, the likelihood of landing that person goes way up. And I would think it would work very similar with your faculty. Some just do it because they want the people here. But what a great thing if they got a $3,000 bonus for each referral that they referred. And as you're looking to grow, it might be an out-of-the-box way to incent people to do that.
Two comments. One, I don't think either of us is looking to grow. This is maintaining our size right now. I mean, actually, in the long run, there are certain types of growth, but the faculty numbers were actually modeled with very little growth. Second thing is the faculty don't really regard, when they're out, the faculty kind of when they're working on hiring, they're doing it for themselves. They're not doing it for Cornell at some level. They are more like co-owners of the operation, and they'd be baffled if I went and told them that I need to give you an incentive to tell us about someone we might hire. They are just chomping at the bit to go out and recruit their friends and recruit their people, and it's because they don't really think of themselves as employees in quite the same sense that a lot of companies do, a lot of company employees do. It really is a different relationship. It actually goes back to what Mike said, the hiring. You know, it's not us telling them, you have to go hire. It's us actually saying, it's okay with us if you go hire, and them sort of running out the door and diving into it and pursuing it in every possible way. Very important part of it is, in fact, to go out and find, milk the networks, and either for people you know or for people they know, and so it, a lot of that's done. I don't know.
We do some things. I'm not sure that is necessary for us, because, as I say, that and Peter says, the faculty themselves want to go out and beat the bushes for colleagues. They're looking to get the best colleagues, but we do some things that are changing. We incentivize people to relocate if we need to. We do some things that, a suggestion was made at the trustees meeting yesterday about corporations now incentivizing people not to retire because they can't really afford at this time a wholesale replacement. We have these phased agreements. We're being as flexible as we can in trying to respond to a really difficult situation. So it's not as though we're very staid in what we're doing and not looking at what succeeds and what is happening in the corporate world. But some things don't quite fit the culture, and some things do.
I'm going to dismiss you if someone doesn't get up to the microphone. No more questions? Okay, well, maybe we should wrap it up, and thank you all for coming.
Thank you.